Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, health, policy, and the media, reporting on fairness and accuracy in reporting, Truth Out, Truth Dig, and other online media outlets. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between the well-being of ourselves as people, the well-being of communities, the well-being of society, and the well-being of our ecosystem, planet Earth. And each week on the show, we talk to different experts, advocates, farmers, authors, scientists, and more about how all of the connection and interaction between the various sectors of our world influence the health and well-being of all and of our habitat, planet Earth. And so it's always a pleasure to talk with different people because, you know, ours is a complex, biologically living system. And, you know, we have a kind of need, you know, an economic sort of drivers that tend to kind of drive us toward a certain kind of simplisticness. But we have great need to understand our world and how and those connections and how they interact in order to live and thrive and survive for the benefit of all during this complex time. On today's show, I'm really delighted to be joined by John Kempf, who's the founder of Advancing Ego Agriculture. We've talked in a great number of shows about regenerative agriculture, and you can hear a whole, you know, variety of experts and specialists in that domain over the last 2 or 3 years on Connect the Dots. I've had the pleasure of hearing John speak and present multiple times at the annual Soil and Nutrition Conference occurring this year, November 14th through 17th in Southbridge, Massachusetts, and he'll be presenting again. I've always enjoyed his presentations, and I'm delighted, John, to have you on the show today and welcome you to Connect the Dots. John is a plant nutrition, hosts a plant nutrition and biostimulants consulting company called Advancing Eco Agriculture. He's a top expert in the field of biological and regenerative farming. Advancing Eco Agriculture was started by John back in 2006 to help fellow farmers by providing the education, tools, and strategies to produce a global effect on the food supply and those who are growing that. He is also the host of the Regenerative Agriculture podcast, where he regularly interviews top scientists and growers about the science and principles of implementing regenerative agriculture on a large scale. And, you know, that is such a key thing because, you know, this is a powerful movement that has been kind of advancing and, you know, and finally has been named, you know, regenerative agriculture in the last several years, but it's been advancing over the last 25 years. And I think it's really important and interesting to get down into the nitty-gritty of it, but it's also, as we will do on today's show, but I think it's also important for people to know that this is scalable, that it has major environmental benefits, as well as benefits to the food supply, and it's something that as it grows and builds can really have a large-scale effect. So it's not just a case of if I happen to have, you know, a farm in my neighborhood or one that supplies my, you know, my local CSA or farmer's market, you know, then I've lucked out. You know, what John has really been looking at is how can this approach be applied, you know, more comprehensively to have the powerful effects that are possible and hoped for. So welcome to Connect the Dots, John Kempf.
Thanks for inviting me, Allison. I'm happy to be here.
So, I mean, could you, I mean, part of what you're really focusing on is how to, you know, advance this field. How did you first get interested in this? And why is regenerative agriculture, such a key movement and strategy for our times.
I grew up on a family fruit and vegetable farm in the snow belt south of Lake Erie in northeast Ohio, close to the Pennsylvania border. When I graduated from school, growing up in an Amish community, when I graduated from school at the age of 14, I was given the responsibility of managing all of the irrigation and the spraying. So I was responsible for foliar, applying all of the fertilizers and all the pesticides, and running pesticides through the irrigation system, running fertilizers through the irrigation system. On a small family farm of where we were growing mixed fruits and vegetables, we were very conventional, very mainstream at the time. I became a licensed pesticide applicator when I was 16 years old. And I was always very fascinated by how plants responded to different nutrient applications and became very intrigued by, started studying plant nutrition. And then in the early 2000s, 2002, 3, and 4, we had a three-year consecutive period in which we lost greater than 70% of each of our four primary crops that we were growing on our farm to a variety of different diseases and insects that we were largely unsuccessful in managing with pesticides. And so this was three consecutive years, very, very powerful experience. And then the third year of that three-year period, I had a really interesting experience that caused me to stop and take notice. And that was, we began renting, in 2004, we began renting a field from a neighboring farm that bordered right up against one of our own fields. So there used to be these two long, narrow strips of fields that, because they were quite narrow, they were being tilled and planted up and down the slope. And that was resulting in erosion and loss of topsoil. So now that we were farming both fields, we switched the direction. The field was wider. We switched the direction the rows were being planted, and we started planting directly across the old field border. So on the soil that we had been farming for the prior decade, we've been growing vegetables on the same soil year after year with a cover crop during the winter months. So we had very continuous pesticide accumulation. And the new soil had been farmed by a neighboring dairy farm that was a small grain alfalfa hay and corn rotation with manure applications and so forth, and without the pesticide applications. So in 2004, we were farming both of these fields side by side, and we planted them into cantaloupe. At harvest time, on the old soil with the history of pesticide application, 80% of the melon leaves were infected with powdery mildew. And on the new soil that had not had the pesticide application, there was no powdery mildew, not 5% or 10% infection, but zero. You couldn't find any. There was this clear knife line right through the center of the field. In fact, the amazing part is it was such a pronounced effect that there were healthy vines at the field border growing right in amongst the unhealthy vines. And that was very much a light bulb moment for me. I wanted to know, what are the differences between those two plants, and what allows one plant to be resistant to powdery mildew when the next plant 2 feet away is susceptible? So from that, I started doing a lot of I started doing even more research and studying into plant nutrition, trying to understand what I was observing, and I discovered that there's an entire body of research, an entire body of agronomic knowledge that is not being applied in today's commercial agriculture. And this entire body of knowledge is based around plant immune systems. And at its very simplest, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but there is an analogy between a plant immune system and our own immune systems. We understand that all of us have our own immune system, but they don't all function equally well. Some people become ill with the first cold or flu bug that comes along, and other people practically never become ill. And the difference between those two is how well their immune system has been supported with nutrition over the course of their entire lifetime, not just in the last 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months, but over their entire life. In fact, from even before they were born. And the same idea holds true for plants as well, that plants also have an immune system. And when that immune system is supported with the proper nutrition, they can be completely resistant to all types of diseases, all types of insects, nematodes, mites, viruses, etc. And we can completely eliminate the need for pesticides. So I became very inspired and very excited by this idea that we could grow really healthy plants. I founded Advancing Eco-Agriculture to help large-scale fruit and vegetable growers achieve these results on scale. And as we started working with growers, we observed that there were two other very important effects that were happening. Not only were we producing crops that were resistant to diseases and insects, but also these fruit and the vegetables that we were growing had a very high protein content. They had a very high fat content. They had a better aroma. They had a better flavor. They had better storability and shelf life. All the quality characteristics that we were looking for increased with nutrition. So for quite some time, there's been this conversation around growing biofortified foods or nutrient-dense foods. And I was quite surprised to discover that when we think of nutrient-dense foods, one common example that people think about is blueberries. Blueberries are supposed to be really good for our health because they boost our immune system because of their anthocyanin content. But interestingly enough, in 1992, Michigan State University conducted some research in which they described that the anthocyanin content of blueberries can vary by a factor of 25x. There's huge variability. You can have two different clamshells of blueberries, but have a completely different anthocyanin content. So I became really inspired by the idea that when we enhance a plant's immune system, these plant immune compounds, we call phytoalexins, terpenoids, bioflavonoids, phenolic compounds. These are all aromatic compounds that are at the foundation of a plant's immune system. And when we grow plants that are resistant to diseases and insects, not only do they have that inherent resistance, but they're also able to transfer that immunity to the people who consume them as food and the animals. And thus, we can have a legitimate conversation about growing food as medicine. As if though that were not exciting enough, the third piece that emerged is that when we are the realization that when we are growing plants at this level of health and this level of vitality, they are also sequestering carbon dioxide and building soil organic matter at rates that are significantly faster than what are normally expected. What the historical research has indicated. And that led us down an interesting pathway of research in which we discovered that what we've come to accept as common and normal is plants which are photosynthesizing at only about 15 to 20% of their inherent genetic capacity. This means that when we give a plant the optimal nutrition, the optimal environment, and we remove the bottlenecks to full photosynthesis, a plant will never go from 20% to 100% photosynthetic efficiency. 100% would only be present in an absolutely ideal environment, which doesn't happen in outdoor production agriculture. But it should be very achievable to go from 20% to 60%. And when that happens, that now means you triple the sugar production in every 24-hour photo period, and that means you triple the carbon dioxide sequestration in every 24-hour photo period. So it's actually possible to sequester carbon dioxide and build soil organic matter much faster than we have historically thought to be the case. And this is very exciting because of what this means for improving soil health, for reducing erosion, improving soil biology, reducing water pollution, and all of the ecological and environmental beneficial impacts that improving soil health is known to have.
Wow.
So a very long answer to your question, but I became really inspired by the idea that if we can change agricultural systems and agricultural models to grow plants that deliver those three objectives, number one, they're resistant to diseases and insects and reduce or eliminate the need for pesticides. Number two, they can produce food as medicine. And number three, that we can regenerate agriculture ecosystems, regenerate soils while we are growing a crop. That agriculture today is a significant contributor and a significant source of many of the ecological and environmental challenges that we face. And it has the potential to be the solution for those problems that it has created and for even other problems that it is not a direct contributor to.
Well, have you done the calculations where, or are you familiar with them that really show the potential for a significant, sequestration of carbon? I mean, we're talking here about what's commonly referred to as drawdown, you know, based on Paul Hawkins' kind of revelation of this potential. But is it something that using the kinds of methods that, you know, you've been investigating and recommend is something that, you know, we could have a real transition and this could be scalable at a level to make a substantive difference in shifting our, you know, kind of harmful climate trajectory that we're on?
The answer is yes and yes. We can absolutely scale these solutions to a global scale, and they will be able to have a very significant impact on carbon drawdown. So there are, when we look at agriculture in the macro context, there are two very distinct and very separate conversations. The one conversation is around rangelands, where when we shift rangeland management to use holistic management, as described by Alan Savory and many others, and begin changing the way we manage livestock grazing, that, in my understanding, can become the most efficient and the most effective method of sequestering carbon dioxide that is known on a very large scale. The second conversation is around cropland. And when we're talking about corn, soybeans, small grain, alfalfa, rice production, et cetera, as well as fruit and vegetable crops, I find it really interesting that today, when we have conversations with agronomists and with growers, the usual assumption is that when you grow corn, you will have a net loss of carbon dioxide, and corn production contributes CO2 to the atmosphere. As recently as, and actually let me clarify that, not so much CO2, but organic matter, that when you grow corn, you will lose organic matter from the soil, which of course ultimately translates to increased CO2 in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
As recently as 1960s and 70s, the leading agronomists of the day indicated that the fastest way to build soil organic matter, which means to sequester CO2, although they were looking at it from an agronomic perspective, they said the fastest way to build soil organic matter is to grow corn. So our perspective on the contributions of corn have completely shifted in the last 50 years. And it's not so much that the corn plant itself has changed, it's the ways that we have managed it and the ways that we are managing it have completely changed.
You know, I just want to interject there because that's a very important point. And, you know, just to unpack that a little, you know, when any given area of, you know, of our interconnected world, which we talk about on this show, whether it's political, whether it's, energy production initiatives, whether it's agriculture, these are all things that I've covered. And, you know, it's very possible and likely that, you know, on a superficial level, one can pick something, target it, and say, you know, this is good and this is bad. So you know, in your example, it's a brilliant example of it. One could say, you know, oh, corn is the problem, or someone else could say meat is the problem, or, you know, we might say this or that initiative in our public life is a problem. And, you know, yes, these things are, you know, can be problems and can function as problems, but the key question that we don't always ask and that you bring up here is how is the way we are managing whatever it is, increasing or, you know, increasing the problem or enhancing the situation and decreasing the problem. And so the key element of it's not this or that, and I should, you know, never consume this or always avoid that or eat more of that, but it's really how it's managed. And this is something that, you know, we don't often ask or think about, that the, and that's exactly what you're looking into, you know, how was that, I mean, your first big wake-up call that put you on this path, how was that land managed and treated? And so if you do have large industries, as we do in a variety of sectors, and agriculture certainly is one, which is saying this is the only way to feed people or this is the way to go, and yet it's found to be a detrimental form of management, you know, what you're pointing out is it's not the corn per se, it's the management. And so what are the differences in management, you know, in this particular case, because I think it's a great example of a systemic, you know, issue that we need to, you know, view more, you know, with a greater perspective. So what is the difference in management there with the corn, for example?
That's an excellent question, and I wholeheartedly agree with the sentiment that you expressed in the case of livestock grazing. There are many conversations happening today saying that consuming meat is a problem because it requires so much water and it has all these environmental impacts. And that is true when meat is grown in a CAFO, but the exact opposite is true when beef is grown, and using beef specifically as an example, when beef is produced in a properly managed grazing environment, they sequester carbon dioxide, they conserve water, and they're the fastest way that we have to, that we know of, to reverse climate change using agriculture on a significant scale. So completely agree with your sentiment that it is really about the management of crops specifically and or in general. We approach the production of crops and plant nutrition from the mainstream perspective, approaches plant nutrition and agronomy with a singular objective, how to produce the highest yields possible. That's it. That's the beginning and the ending of the conversation. How can we produce the highest yields possible? And we asked a slightly different question. How can we produce the highest yields possible and concurrently produce the highest quality? How can we produce both high yields and disease and insect resistance and high quality fruit at the same time? Mm-hmm. The answer is simply that there's a twofold answer. Part one is that we manage nutrition differently, where historically, or at least in recent history, nutrition has been optimized purely for yield. We optimize nutrition for both yield and quality. So that means that perhaps we put on significantly less nitrogen, less phosphorus, and we add more calcium, and we add more zinc and manganese and copper and boron to increase the plant's immune system. So we approach nutrition. As a result of approaching nutrition differently, that means we tension to a much broader array of nutrients, trace elements, and so forth. Then the second part is that we seek to enhance biology and not suppress it. And so there are many agricultural practices and products in use which intensely degrade soil biology. Those could be synthetic nitrogen applications or herbicide or fungicide applications, and even many fertilizers that produce an enhanced plant response, suppress soil biology. Our approach has been to say that every product that we apply needs to enhance plant growth and health, and it needs to enhance biology at the same time. It can't have this two-edged sword effect where one edge is positive and the other negative. So the combination of those two effects, that's a very broad generalization, but I think that's at the foundation of our approach to thinking differently about how to manage plant nutrition and how to manage soil biology to produce a completely different outcome.
So you're looking, you know, this is really also a very systemic perspective, because you're not just looking at the single product, you know, you're looking at the health and ongoing health and revitalization of the context. So this is, you know, the kind of opposite of this extractive mode that has gotten us into trouble, you know, on so many, in so many different industries and in so many different levels. And, you know, it's kind of, it was a kind of naive approach that, you know, kind of proceeded unchecked. And yet, if we're not also preserving and restoring simultaneously the context, it's literally like, you know, killing the goose that laid the golden egg. So you actually can have methods, and regenerative agriculture has methods for doing that combination rather than, you know, just the one thing where, you know, you get a great, you know, ear of corn or something, but it's at the expense of the field and of your capacity to grow more. It's, you know, it's a kind of dead-ending system. I mean,
exactly.
Let me, when we're talking about dead-ending systems too, and this is maybe a fairly obvious kind of question, but, you know, what about the seeds themselves? Because, you know, one of the issues with GMO seeds is that, you know, they're patented, they're owned, they, you know, they kind of dead end and die and you have to buy them again, rather than, you know, the tradition in farming of sharing seeds, saving seeds, you know, and all of that. I mean, I'd, you know, love to hear you talk about, you know, seeds and seed quality and, you know, the approach in regenerative agriculture to that.
Well, genetics and seed quality are a topic that I'm fascinated by, and I'll offer a perspective that might be not frequently heard of. Mm-hmm. What I think one of the significant pieces that has largely been missed is that different varieties of a given crop can vary significantly in their ability to absorb nutrients from the soil. We know that some varieties of crops are more resistant to disease than others. So we have disease-resistant varieties, disease-susceptible varieties, to any one of dozens of different possible diseases across different crops. And the connections that we often fail to consider is the fact that those disease susceptibilities are rooted in differences in the nutritional profile. So if we have one apple variety particularly good at absorbing cobalt, it will be completely resistant to bacteria.
John, I'm losing you on the sound
and if
here.
You have another variety that does not pick, it will be resistant to apples. You can plant on the same soil side by side. So there are varietal differences. Okay, sorry about quality still coming through clearly. Let me start over. Still there?
It's a little warbly. Yeah, it's a little warbly. Is, you know, I don't
all right.
Know if you can. Yeah, see what you can do in terms of plugging it in or something, or being close to something. I'm not sure. But, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't changed the space that I'm in, but let me see, and let's just, yeah.
It's better right now, whatever, you know, it's better right now.
Okay, cool. So there are varietal differences in plants' ability to absorb nutrition from the soil. We can have one apple variety that is very good at picking up cobalt, and it will be completely resistant to apple scab. You have another variety that is not good at picking up cobalt, and it becomes very susceptible to apple scab, even though they're planted on the same soil side by side. And these differences in capacity to absorb nutrients are particularly pronounced in many historical varieties versus modern hybrids. We often observe, and we have hundreds of thousands of laboratory samples where we actually analyze the nutrition of plants in the field as a part of our agronomic management. We can see that many of the older open pollinated varieties or even some of the older hybrids have much stronger root systems and are much better at absorbing nutrients from the soil than some of the more modern genetics. So there is a trend of reducing nutritional integrity in the modern genetics. So for those reasons, I think seed quality and managing genetics, nutrition, that conversation is a very important conversation, but it needs to be expanded past just thinking about the challenges of GMOs, past just the challenges of seed sovereignty, which are important and very critical issues, but there are also issues of thinking about the actual nutritional capacity of a given of older seeds. So I would say that makes the issues of seed sovereignty and seed saving from historical varieties even more important than we might have considered.
Well, because they bring something to the mix that would not otherwise be present.
They bring nutritional profiles and the capacity to absorb nutrients from the soil many modern varieties have missed. And it's largely, again, because many of the modern hybrids and modern varieties have been bred singular objective, yield. How to get the highest yield possible. And an important question to say that we can either have high yields or we can have quality. We can't have both. That's not the case at all. The reality is that we can have really high yields and high quality at the same time. In fact, I would suggest, based on the work that we have done with many people, is that when you increase health and vitality and vigor, you can't stop the yields from increasing. So the highest yielding crops can also be the highest quality crops.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah, that's really amazing. What do you find in bringing this to farmers, and is this something that more and more farmers are interested in adopting? Are they kind of having some kind of parallel experience to your original wake-up call where, you know, this is something they're looking for, it's good news, they're receptive to it, or is it more, a bit of a hard sell because they are so accustomed to this other, you know, these other methods of growing?
Yeah, farmers, I have a lot of sympathy for farmers because they are in a very challenging profession. They are exposed to an incredible amount of risk. They have very slim margins. They have high overheads. And farming is more than just a living. It's a livelihood. It's a way of life. It's their family. It's their home. So there is a tremendous amount of emotion involved in making a change. And this is a very significant change. And every grower, every farmer comes to making that change from a different place. Some of them are as a result of health challenges in their family. Some of them are as a result of economics. So there's different pathways. But what I have observed is that I get really passionate about the idea that we can develop agricultural models and scale them globally to deliver the three objectives that I spoke of: reduce pesticide application, food as medicine, and sequester carbon and rebuild soil health. But those are conversations that don't necessarily inspire growers to change. They find them inspiring, and actions, things, results that farmers would desire to take. The reality is that farmers, perhaps more than many other professions, have a deep desire to do the right thing. They desire to better for the next generation. And many of them, they feel stuck in a system and they're uncertain of how to make changes. So our approach, when we speak to farmers, we find that they are inspired by the idea of being able to reduce pesticides and produce better quality food and improve soil health, but not enough to actually change the decisions that they're making. And it's not because they don't desire to make those changes, it's because they perceive it as being too high risk. So our conversation when we speak to growers is almost exclusively a conversation about economics. We can help you be more successful, make more money, and increase your profitability by managing nutrition differently than what you are doing right now. And as we start going down this pathway, all of a sudden growers observe that, oh my goodness, I don't have these diseases anymore. I don't have these insect pests anymore. My fruit stores better. I have a higher test weight. I have a higher protein content. And all of these other benefits begin accruing and are noticed as well. And also we make very certain to point them out on the pathway to improving profitability. But I really believe very much that you achieve what you incentivize. And if we can show growers a very strong economic incentive, that will be the most powerful way to drive change on a global scale.
Do you see a role for government to play? You know, government has, in effect, put weight on the wrong side of the scale, in effect, by subsidizing pesticide agriculture, you know, for many decades. Do you see a way for government to help redress the matter and support the kind of transition to this ecologically more sensible and health-promoting form of agriculture?
Well, there certainly could be a number of ways that there could be very positive policy impacts in changing crop insurance programs, better incorporate coverable, encouraging directly farmers to use cover, compensating for carbon drawdown. There's any number of policy changes that could have a significant positive effect. And then we could also remove some of the policies that have been applying pressure on the wrong pedal, as you described. I find it very interesting. I have many visitors from foreign countries who come to observe the work that we're doing, and particularly from New Zealand, they have some very innovative agricultural practices that have been driven by necessity because of the very harsh climates and the environments that they're producing in. And there is a fairly common refrain, particularly from the Aussies that I speak with, that the crop insurance and the subsidy program have stifled innovation in agriculture to an extraordinary degree here. And I see that perspective very clearly. And so I would suggest that, yes, the national cheap food policy has had a significant impact on developing our agriculture as it exists today.
So it's really on us to, you know, as citizens, to support changes that would redress the situation. Because otherwise we're, you know, leaving it to farmers to fight, you know, with one arm tied behind their back while, you know, the government is doing something else and, you know, overriding that and getting into the mix in a detrimental manner.
Farmers are, I mentioned this earlier, I have a tremendous sympathy for growers and farmers. Obviously, I grew up on a farm. I managed a farm of my own for a while, although I don't do that today anymore. And many farmers feel unappreciated. They feel disrespected because they have an incredibly challenging profession. It's incredibly challenging. That's very demanding. In many cases, particularly in the case of commodity crops, they're not being paid very well for that at all. In fact, many of them are consuming their equity and have been for 8 years out of the last decade. 4 years out of the last five. So it's an extremely challenging economic environment. And then the recent trade challenges or trade wars that we've had with China have had a significant impact. It's just this compounding effect of so many challenges, a lack of appreciation or perceived lack of appreciation from customers, and combined with policy changes that they perceive to be detrimental, increasing financial pressures, and so on. There's a lot of pressures. I think the and some of it also is I would say is not undeserved, because yes, there is an existing system, a status quo that many farmers have felt to be trapped in. But there are also many farmers who've moved outside of that trapped-in status. And the reality is that we don't need any more growers growing triple-stack genetic models. So my message to growers would be that if you are compensated, and if you want to trap, you need to begin producing non-commodity crops that you are actually compensated for quality. And there are many of those. So The mainstream system as it exists now certainly has produced a lot of challenges for farmers, and they feel by a system of the banking, insurance, and crop support environment that for those farmers who are deeply embedded in that system, it can make it very difficult to step outside of it.
Yeah, because they made an investment, and how do you turn around and shift that? Even as it, you know, it's a bad and difficult situation, and also with the, you know, the conglomerates. I mean, they, you know, they come in and they buy up farms, and only huge, you know, kind of mega farms can succeed, and they're doing it in this kind of, you know, almost automated style. Of growing, you know, with these harmful inputs and all that.
Those farmers, when you say that they can only succeed in the very automated style, those are precisely the types of commodity situations that the farmers who wish to survive need to get out of. The very successful farmers, with, and there are many of them, are improving they're becoming more successful scaling down. Instead of farming 3,000 acres in the Midwest, they might be reducing to 1,200 acres or to 800 acres. They're producing higher value crops. They're no longer producing commodity crops. So there certainly is opportunity for growers to move out of the commodity crops, to shift their management practices, focus on regenerative agriculture practices, and improve profitability. Dozens, hundreds of examples of that. Successfully, who've improved their profitability. We're past the early adopters, be the people who are using regenerative agriculture, and we're really majority. So I see tremendous positivity. There's many things to be positive about our agricultural system in North America and the world in general. Yes, we have significant challenges that need to be solved, but the important part is that we don't need to learn anything new, to solve the problems that we have. There's no new knowledge. There certainly is new knowledge that we would benefit from. There is validation that we would benefit from. But the reality is that we already know everything that we need to know to change the system on a global scale. We simply need to implement the practices and the management tools that we already know are successful.
Well, that is very hopeful, and I think that's actually the perfect entree point to bring up the 9th Annual Soil and Nutrition Conference occurring November 14th through 17th, 2019, in Southbridge, Massachusetts. I know people are coming from all over the country, but anyone certainly in the Northeast, you know, this is a meeting place for the discussion of regenerative agriculture, capacities and methods, meeting with the leaders and thought leaders who have devised a lot of this and are using it in practice. It's very interesting. I've attended it over multiple years because it's really interesting for people who are foodies to get this broader and more in-depth perspective. And also they have terrific videos of all the talks that are available after the fact. So, you know, the Soil and Nutrition Organization, Association, you know, functions as an educational arm as well for people who are interested in knowing more. And so, you know, anyone, and of course you are presenting again this year there, as well as a number of people that we've interviewed on Connect the Dots presently and in the past. So, you know, I really do counsel anyone wanting to know more about this to go to their website, soilandnutrition.org. And also, just to give your organization and podcast a second mention, the specific techniques that John Kempf is working with, you can learn more about at his website. His organization is called Advancing Ecoagriculture, and his website is advancingecoag.com. And John, you also do a podcast, Regenerative Agriculture Podcast, where and you have you know, have interviewed a number of top scientists and growers. So if, you know, as a farmer, as a grower, as an agronomist, as a student of agriculture, you know, studying, you know, as someone who'd like to become a farmer, there's really a lot of knowledge and information that you've been gathering as well that's available to people. So just, you know, wanting to kind of shout out on that. You know, I just have I guess, you know, having been in this since 2006, right? So that's 13 years. I mean, can you describe your own perspective on how this movement has grown? You know, we, you know, for many years from the perspective of people who eat food, you know, we've had organic food and non-GMO food and various kinds of food, and now, you know, regenerative agriculture, which is kind of like the advanced place, the advanced degree of some of these long pioneered methods. How have you personally seen the movement growing in, you know, from when you began making these discoveries year after year to, you know, what's going on now?
It's been a very exciting journey, and it's an exciting time in regenerative agriculture. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it is the more recent buzzword that is catching a lot of media attention and is really proliferating in the mainstream quite quickly. But for those of us who've been involved in it over a decade or longer, there has been a very interesting shift within the agricultural community, particularly, which I've been really actually surprised and encouraged by. So my thought process, when I first realized the implications for what regenerative agriculture could really mean, that it could mean that we could grow plants that were resistant to diseases and insects, that were producing food as medicine, and that was regenerating soil health, sequestering carbon dioxide, reducing pollution or eliminating pollution, and having all of these benefits, I became very excited by inspired by this potential. And my personal mission, what I'm really passionate about, is I want to have these regenerative models of agriculture become the standard, become the status quo against which everything else is compared globally by 2040. And I believe that's a very realistic goal. We're well on the pathway to achieving that goal. And I thought very clearly about how, and tried to think very strategically about how do we get there from where we are today. And my thought process a decade ago was that the place to begin and the first place to focus is on the high-value fruit and vegetable growers. Because, first of all, they're a relatively small audience. Secondly, they have the most direct impact on the quality of the food that people are consuming directly. And third, they have the biggest economic incentives to change. They get compensated directly for marketable fruit quality and the proportion of marketable fruit. So in the United States, in the 2015 census, or that was published in 2015, there were a total of 69,335 fruit and vegetable growers in the U.S. at that moment in time. Of those, just over 6,900, 6,923, had produced greater than $500,000 in annual revenue per farm, and those less than 7,000 farms produced 90% or over 90% of the domestic supply chain, the domestically produced supply chain of fruits and vegetables and nuts. So that's actually quite a small number, 7,000 growers. And my thought process was that we want to work with those 7,000 growers because when we work with those 7,000 growers, that's where we have the most significant and most immediate impact on the quality of the food that people eat. And also, generally, the historical trend within the agricultural industry and the farming space has been that new ideas and new technology is often first adopted and developed in the fruit and vegetable production world and then moves into broadacre crops, corn, beans, small grains, livestock operations, and so forth. So our approach for the last decade has been to work with the high-value fruit and vegetable crops. We're having a very significant impact there, which I'm very excited about. And I have a lot of fun working with our growers. But what has really kind of caught me by surprise and what has been very unexpected is the way that regenerative agriculture has shifted into the mainstream in the broadacre production world very quickly. And very recently as well, in the last 3 years, 3 to 4 years. 3 or 4 years ago, 5 years ago, the term regenerative agriculture was, I won't say that it was completely unknown, but it was not really a part of the conversation for growers on the high plains and throughout the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And today, it's in almost every publication. It comes up in the majority of conversations. So there's been a tremendous shift in awareness, and that shift in awareness is being accompanied by a shift in actual practice. Practices in the field are beginning to change. And those obviously take longer, but the reality is that change doesn't actually happen in the field. It happens. And that's one of the I founded or started hosting the Regenerative Agriculture podcast. I have a lot of fun on the podcast. And for anyone who's interested in the science and the technology behind regenerative agriculture and how to implement it on scale, I would highly recommend it. Not because I'm the host, but because I have hosted some amazing guests who say some of the most incredible things. And it's quite inspiring. It's quite inspiring to me to have a podcast that is titled the Regenerative Agriculture Podcast. And not even 2 years after starting it, it's among the top of the list on iTunes for all podcasts in agriculture, not just regenerative agriculture, but agriculture in general. It's approaching the top of the list. And to me, that is very exciting and speaks directly to the shift that is happening in agriculture at large.
Oh, that is. That's wonderful. You know, also commenting that it's, you know, it's important both for our health and nutrition and also, obviously, for the ecological health of the planet. And even as we're recording this show, Australia, which is a drought region, you know, is being hit by terrible fires. And, you know, they're evacuating Sydney. We've seen fires, you know, hit the west coast of this country with people fleeing their homes. And, you know, we haven't talked about it much in this conversation, but, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit from you about, you know, the role of a regenerative agriculture in preventing drought and keeping, you know, the water in the soil and on the planet.
I recently hosted a podcast interview with Walter Yenny, who is a renowned climatologist from Australia. And the short synopsis of that interview is that regenerative agriculture has the capacity to completely restore the hydrological cycles, the water cycles on a planet, when we begin managing soils and plants differently. And so many of the drought challenges that we have, and I would say the climate variability that has been happening, an increasing intensity of climactic events and swings from extreme heat to extreme cold, extreme wet, extreme dry. Again, we collectively already know many of the things that need to be done to stabilize the climate and to reverse those trends if we simply apply what we already know.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So important. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on Connect the Dots, John Kempf. Listeners, I hope you will take the opportunity to tune in to John's podcast, as well as check out the videos by many thought leaders and the actual conference event occurring at soilandnutrition.org here in mid-November to, you know, gain more knowledge of this subject. We also have a number over the last 3 years, really, quite a few special podcast that we've done on regenerative agriculture with a host of wonderful experts, all the way from Fred Kirschenman, who's kind of a founding father of family farming, you know, and organic farming, to Dave Chapman, who's, you know, at Real Organic. We've just had a whole host of different people presenting. You'll find that in the Connect the Dots archive. And if you've enjoyed this podcast with John Kempf, you can share it through our archive at connectthedots.podbean.com, where it will be available. And, you know, this is really such an important initiative on so many different levels. And I think this, John, I want to thank you for, you know, this wonderful and complete explanation. You know, thank you, listeners, for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And so be well and keep marching forward in company with all our relations on this beautiful planet that we call home.